because that's important. The program today, there are some copies on the table to the left, so you're welcome to pick one up. But we've got a fairly free-flowing program, which will be obviously up to Arjun. We're starting at 8:30. At 10:45, we'll stop and we'll have an offering of lunch, dana, to the Sangha. Now, today we're not having a pinnipata. So at 11:30, then we'll have our lunch. So the 8 preceptors and volunteers will be served first. And then we just ask you if we could have a little bit of help to cleaning up, please. That will be much appreciated. And then the afternoon program starts at 1 p.m. and we finish today at 3 p.m. And just a reminder, Arjun is speaking for those of you who bought tickets. There is the talk tonight on loving life facing death, and that will commence at 7:30 sharp. So we ask you to be there much earlier than that so you can take your seat. Thank you. That's all I have to say. Thank you, Arjun.
Thank you, Liv. Okay, we just have the Tiwana. Water, okay. That's good. Excellent, in case. So, welcome everybody to today's meditation retreat. See how much meditation we can actually do, not just talking about it, but doing it. And for the meditation, the idea of meditation is to learning how to get your mind to be really still and peaceful. When it's peaceful and still, amazing things happen. It's when the biggest problem people have with meditation is their restless mind. Always wanting something, searching for something, wanting to get something. But as I did... As I did mention yesterday, that one of the most important teachings of my master, Ajahn Chah, was we meditate to let go of things, not to get more things. So our goal, if you call it a goal, is actually to simplify, to let go of so many things. So we come here today, and the food will be provided later. There's nothing you really need right now. So all of that is provided. So all you really need to do is just to be here. To be here, not going anywhere, not doing anything, but just learning how to relax and rest. And of those many stories which I've said about meditation, there was one which comes to my mind when I was doing a happiness conference in Sydney. There was a professor from Berkeley. No, sorry, not Berkeley, from Stanford University, which was very rich university, very well endowed, and he managed to get funding for an experiment on meditation and other forms of relaxation. He split his class into two, and at random, he sent half of them to a meditation retreat for the day, just like you're doing here. And the other half, he sent, all expenses paid, to a Californian spa. And in a spa, I've never been to a spa, but they say they have like hot baths and massage and hot oil and stones. I don't know what else they do over there. But he wanted to find out the efficacy of meditation. And at the end of the day, they brought both groups back, gave them a standard psychology test, and the results were stunning. That the people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than the people who went to meditation. And which told me that somewhere some people don't know how to teach meditation. That is not meditation as far as I understand it. That with meditation you relax the body so deeply that it's better than going to a spa. And it's certainly far cheaper. And also, you not only relax the body, you relax the mind, that you get to a wonderful state of stillness. Because stillness is the key. Just to get these little basic meditation housekeeping rules, you know, just out of the way. Some of the translations of these Pali terms, ancient terms like samadhi and calling it concentration, is something which I have been very disappointed with for so many years, because meditation has got nothing to do with concentration. Concentration, which is done through force, through willpower, never reaches a place of stillness. And indeed, the word for samadhi does not mean concentration. It was a word which was suggested by Professor Rhys Davids in the 1860s as a way of trying to describe what happens when you practice this Buddhist meditation method. It was a good idea, a nice stab. He was also the one who actually coined the word mindfulness. That was brilliant. But he was not brilliant when it came to the idea of samadhi, meaning concentration. It means something a lot different, stillness. And of course, how can you be still? And of course, this is my usual exercise. I usually hold out a glass of water, and my job, my purpose, is to try and make this glass, this cup of water, be perfectly still. The water represents my mind, and trying to make this still is the job of meditation. So now, Venerable Arunabihari, because you know there's no such thing as a free lunch, so I have to make you work now. And you've done this before with me. This cup of water, is the water, has it stopped moving yet? Or is it still agitated? Yes. Why? Because I'm not being mindful. I'm paying no attention to it. I'll now be mindful of it. Has it stopped moving yet? Still is moving. Because I'm not concentrating. I will now be mindful and concentrate. Has it stopped moving yet? A little bit more moving. Now, this is not a joke. I don't play around here. When you concentrate, your mind moves even more. Have you ever noticed that? So what I do is, there's a very simple way. What I was taught by monks like Ajahn Chah, and when you go back to read the original teachings of the Buddha, you see it in there too. A very easy way of keeping this water perfectly still, with so much ease, you put it down. Have you ever heard the word let go, detach, don't grasp, leave things alone? If you put it down, it becomes peaceful, all by itself. Now, Venerable, that water, is it still? Yes. There's no way I could hold it that still. Now that is a very important little message there. This is how we meditate. This is how we don't meditate. And that means that people do get stressed out trying to meditate, and they'd rather go to a spa. They get much more peaceful. So we can't afford going to a spa. So instead, we can learn how to make the mind and the body just so peaceful by learning how to leave it alone, to let it go, to put it down, and stop worrying about it. In other words, stop being so restless. What is restlessness anyway? Why do people think so much? And there's two reasons why people think so much. The first reason is they believe that by thinking they can solve their problems, and that they can work out the meaning of existence, that they can figure out the cause of all their problems. Have you ever noticed that thinking never actually gets to a solution, but it just makes more thoughts? And the great insights, where we do actually literally think outside the box, we see beyond, that always comes when our mind is perfectly still. And the usual example, which everybody has experienced, is when you can't remember somebody's name. And that happens to me so often, not because of my age, it's because I go to so many different Buddhist communities, so many different countries, so many different groups, and sometimes people come to me and say, "Oh, I saw you in Jakarta last week. Do you remember me?" And I say, "Listen, there was 2,500 people there." Of course I can't remember you. But it was wonderful just to know that if you are very peaceful and still, solutions come up, names come up. And this is one of the great ways of innovation. This is just the side effect of meditation. Those of you who have really difficult problems to solve in life, learn how to be still. And then answers tend to come up. Really strange, innovative answers. Because of my connections in science, that one of the people which I was always impressed with was a physicist called Brian Josephson of Cambridge. He was a person who basically he developed the idea of quantum tunneling, and it became the basis for supercomputing. And of course, at the time, his discovery was not accepted. It was impossible. It was considered to be crazy. But eventually, experiments proved he was right. Sorry. And he was awarded a Nobel Prize for physics. And the reason I mention that person, because he got that insight after meditating, at the end of his meditation. It was a meditation-produced Nobel Prize. And that's not a joke. And there's many people like that who actually make incredible breakthroughs, because most thinking just goes one thought after another thought after another thought. It goes in a narrow line. But when we're peaceful and still, we can see so many different ways. Thinking is just basically working over old stuff. Being still is where innovation begins. So stillness is a marvelous ground, a fertile ground of new understandings and solutions to intractable problems. So I say that in order to try and undermine your reliance on thinking as a problem solver. Instead, we develop our emotional wisdom and feeling so we understand. But of course, how do we become that still? And that is the most difficult thing. And the other thing which I was going to say, I'll please find a seat somewhere. There's some seats up on the stage here, but you have to shave your hair off to get those. That's the cost. And that's one thing about stillness. And the other thing about stillness is stillness is not a state which is static. Stillness grows and develops. This is, sometimes people used to ask me about Ajahn Chah's title of his book, Still Water Flowing. Like some Zen koan. What does it mean? If it's still, it can't be flowing. But the truth of the matter is, once your mind becomes still, it starts to develop. It gets more energized. It dives deeper in to itself and into the reality of existence, as things which you thought were stable and solid tend to vanish and disappear as you go deeper and deeper into things. So there's many different levels of stillness, and what you think is the most still state you could ever experience, it goes deeper and deeper. It's a way to experience profound reality through stillness. And it's not something which is beyond anybody. Sometimes that I've been caught out, I've been caught stereotyping people. You know, sometimes we do that. You know, we see somebody, in this particular case, it was maybe a 20, 30-year-old man who came to one of my meditation retreats in Perth. And this 20 or 30-year-old man, he didn't look like a typical meditator, whatever a typical meditator is, because he was really big, he had curly hair, he was Caucasian, and he had tattoos all over him. He looked some really rough guy. And for those of you who visited the retreat center which I built over in Perth, in Jhana Grove, 6 kilometers from there is a prison. And so I assumed that this fellow was got the wrong place. And I said, if you want to visit your friends, they're up the road 6 kilometers. This is the Buddhist meditation retreat. Sometimes you do make stupid mistakes, and I make those stupid mistakes all the time. And I tell everyone about it. It makes fun. It's making stupid mistakes as a teacher in a running vihara. It gives you more sort of material for your talks. So anyway, but he said no, he was booked on the retreat, and I checked. His name was down there. And that was the man who was the star meditator of that retreat. You know, he achieved these incredible states, which, you know, we'll probably talk about later on, called the jhanas. And I don't, you know, say a person's got a jhana unless I'm really, really sure. And this fellow had one. The last person I'd ever expect. But then, the reason I repeat that is because each one of you, if you haven't got a jhana yet, after all these years of meditating, get some tattoos. No, that's only a joke. Don't do that. There we go. There's the fellow there. Yay. And it was just chat. Very good. Excellent. But what happens is that any human being, if they know how to let go and be still, that is how they can get into some of the deepest of states of meditation. And that is where you find the most profound, deepest teachings of the Buddha. Not in the books. The books are just like the Lonely Planet guide to meditation. It's like they describe an area of humanity, of the mind, and what happens inside. And it's the same any other teachings you get. They're just the words which are pointing the way to a deep experience of the mind. And to explain what I mean, I went to our Bhikkhuni monastery in Perth once, and they asked for us actually to do a committee meeting. And then they asked, can we have a teaching? I said, I have to run off. Just any old teaching, quick one. And so I said, look, I need to go to the toilet. Can you please tell me where the toilet is? Now, I've built a lot of that place. I know, and looked over the designs of it as well. So I know where everything is. They were a bit surprised what I was up to. I was obviously up to one of my tricks. And they said, oh, the toilet's there. You can see it, just male toilet. So I went to the toilet door, and I pretended, I never did it, I pretended to urinate on the door. It was quite kosher. I didn't do anything. But they said, what are you doing? So this is my Dhamma teacher, which you won't forget. You said that was the toilet there. And so it says, male toilet, on the door. So that's why I was pretending to urinate. And they said, it's inside. Oh, why didn't you put that on the label there on the sign? Male toilet inside. Because words, descriptions, signs, they can, if you take them just on face value, they can be very deceiving. So when you see male toilet or female toilet, you put it on the door, exit, is that a door over there, what I can see? That's not the exit. The exit's on the other side of the door. So this is one of the reasons why that the words can be misunderstood so easily. Which is why that we learn how to get way beyond those words into silence. And of course the other reason why that people find it difficult to actually to be away from silence. Ooh, that must be a ghost. Boom, 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 going bang in the night. So please turn off your mobile phones or anything which goes beep, beep. And imagine, I sometimes imagine, what would have happened if they had, you know why they call them cell phones, don't you? Because they imprison you, that's what they call cell phones. And to prove the point, that you find that just the more bars you have on your signal, where do bars and cells come from? The more imprisoned you are. If you have no bars on your little thing which says what your reception is, the fewer bars, the more freedom. So it's a cell phone. And actually, the other little joke, just to let you know, is you know that your body is a prison. And I can prove it very easily. Why your body is a prison? Because it's made up of cells. You like that one? For change. At last I've got one you haven't heard before, which you like. Hooray, success. I can go home now. But anyway, your body is a bit of a prison because when you meditate, that's one of the first things we have to get so still, so peaceful. So our body just disappears and vanishes. What a wonderful thing that is. Not to feel hot, not to feel cold, not to feel itchy, but to go beyond that. So what we actually do is when we start meditating, you know, to be able to calm everything down, we just learn how to sit comfortably. And you don't need to sit on the floor to get nice meditation. You can sit on chairs. So well done all those people sitting on chairs. You probably get much deeper meditation than all these people who are trying to prove something by sitting on the floor. Doesn't matter, sometimes you're more comfortable on the floor, which is fine. Some of the best seats in a Buddhist meditation center, the ones which usually go first, are the ones which allow you to lean against the wall. You are very smart over there. Oh, actually, you haven't leaned against the wall yet. But that's actually because it's very comfortable. The idea is, this is not indulgence. It's finding the comfortable place for your body so you can let go of all concern for the body. It's fine. And you can let it go. In the same way that where you parked your car today, hopefully not in somebody's driveway. Otherwise, somebody come rushing in like they did last year. Could somebody move this car? But it can't be as bad as some of the disciples in Perth who want to waste that, not this year, thank goodness, but the year before. Though we told everybody, look, we have to park with kindness to our neighbours. And the ranger will be doing a tour to make sure everybody is parking properly. Because they had complaints from the locals, and so the council ranger came around. And somebody, they parked in front of the ranger, so the ranger couldn't get out. He was hemmed in. and I think that was going a bit too far. They got fined, and there's no way you can talk the ranger out of forgiving that one, because that was really stupid. And so that reminds me of Voltaire's famous saying. The only way, this was like, you know, Voltaire was a great philosopher, playwright, and amazing sort of sense of humor. He said the only way to really understand the mathematical concept of infinity, which, you know, infinity is a huge word, the only way to really understand that is start to thinking about the extent of human stupidity. Which is, you know, it's quite true. You know, maybe we don't like to admit it, but some of the stupid things we do. And anyway, we go back to just learning just how to relax our body, sitting comfortably. And even for those of you traditional Buddhists, even the Buddha, he sat under a Bodhi tree in the shade. In those days, Bodh Gaya, Uwele it was called, was like a park. It was like the domain, but with nobody there. A beautiful tree, a nice river. He just had an incredible meal, which was made for heavenly beings by Sujata. And he got some grass to make a nice comfortable seat to sit on. And there, well fed, comfortable, quiet, then he sat and managed to get into deep meditation. There was no force involved. There was a letting go involved. A letting go and in comfort too. So, I've got into the habit teaching meditation now to allow people to really experience, be mindful of their body first of all. And even the Buddha said, Kayagata Sati, the mindfulness of the body, is of great value. And it's very important at the beginning of the meditation to be aware of this vehicle which one uses. And again, going back to that car simile, if you know your car is well parked, it's locked up, no valuables visible through the window, you've looked after it, it's safe. Which means you don't have to worry about it. It's going to be there for you when the meditation day is over. The same with your body. You make sure it's all set up quite correctly, comfortable, not too hot, not too cold, and you can leave it alone for half an hour, or even longer. And it will be fine when you come out of your meditation. So you look after your body first of all. And it also develops the two most important parts of basically what you do, or rather what you don't do. The mindfulness and the kindness. Kindness is another word for letting go. Opening the door of your heart to somebody, as I was saying in Malvern Town Hall on my first evening here. Learning how to love yourself is opening the door of your heart, not trying to change yourself, but just being kind to yourself. With all of your failings and faults, you're not a perfect human being. No one is. But you're kind to this body. When you have that beautiful kindness, it's letting it be with caring for it and mindfulness. It's just so easy to relax everything in your body. Relaxing. By relaxing this body, you are preparing it for meditation. And once this body is cared for and relaxed, it's amazing just what your body feels like. It does actually feel like the people who went to the spa. Relaxed and delightful. So, of course, I could never afford a spa. Don't have any money. But I know how to relax my body. Relax it to the max. It feels so nice. So nice. The pleasure of relaxation. Sometimes, as a Buddhist, I was afraid of pleasure. Delight. You'll get attached. That's wrong. There are some pleasures and delights which lead you deeper into letting go. and the delight of a relaxed body is one of them. As soon as I felt my body just so relaxed, and I focused on the delight which was right in front of me, then the body got more relaxed. It was a vehicle to really getting into deep relaxation of the body. Once the body was really relaxed, then I could let it go. It wasn't a problem. It's like having parked my car with a security system on in a really good place, so it would be there for me later. Nothing to worry about. And then I could go into my emotional world, the mind. And especially with that emotional world, the mind, it was first of all just all this thinking. Why are you thinking? And the other thing I was going to mention about thought, one of the reasons we think too much is because we're afraid of what will happen if we don't think. We're not used to silence. And so because of that, because people just think, how can you be silent? Then you just fall asleep, you become unconscious. It's the nature of the brain to think. And to prove them wrong, I usually perform this little exercise. This is exercise, is I want you to listen to me, but I also want you to be aware of the reaction inside your mind as I'm speaking. How you respond to this way of talking. Because as I am speaking, you will begin to notice that there are some pauses, bit between my words. In those spaces, what was going on in your mind? You were silent. You were in listening mode, not in reacting mode, not in thinking mode. There it is again. And you see just how easy it is to be silent, and how beautiful it is. You don't need to think. And it is just like a cool place of peace which is there for you. So by allowing people to have a taste of a silent mind, people are not afraid of it anymore. When it comes, they realize that is where wisdom, where peace, where even enlightenment will come. Not from the thoughts. They go round and round and round. They drive you crazy. And they are cause of arguments with a silent mind. That's so cool. So that when we see our mind, our emotional world, we check just how busy it is. How peaceful are you right now? This is where I started to develop what I call the peaceometer. It's just a pretty quiche word. Speedometer, an election swingometer, and whatever ometer you have. This is the peaceometer. How peaceful are you? So this is becoming mindful, aware of an important part of your mind. When you say be aware of your mind, it's like this huge thing. What part of my mind should I be aware of? Be aware of how peaceful you are or how agitated you are. The peaceometer. So to help, give it a number. 1 to 10. Right now. You don't need to speak it out. You know, how peaceful are you? From 1 to 10. Now, at least you're aware of how your mind, how peaceful it is. Now, number two, what makes it more peaceful? What makes it agitated? You discover for yourself the cause of peace in your mind. And for those of you who are experts in Buddhism, you'll find that's the third Satipatthana practice. Knowing a mind, if it's indeed in deep peace, or if it's agitated. This is classic practice. And the cause of these things, the arising and passing away, the cause of peace, and the cause of agitation. Find out. And that gives you, once you understand the way your mind works, and what causes peace, it's pretty easy to generate more peace in the mind and to move away from agitation. So what causes agitation in your mind? It is wanting something. And for those of you, again, classic Buddhist teachings, when you want something, you will find that it disturbs your mind. Because we call that Second Noble Truth meditation. The two types of meditation. Second Noble Truth meditation. What's the Second Noble Truth? Wanting causes suffering. Have you heard that before? Second Noble Truth, craving is the cause of suffering. Wanting causes separation from where you are, where you want to be. So wanting causes you stress. In the world you have to want something, but when you're meditating, that's wanting free zone. So give it a try, I don't want anything in the whole world. Later on afterwards I get something. But right now, wanting, being peaceful. And then, when you let go of wanting, it's third noble truth. Let go of wanting, there's no suffering. And that brings back to Ajahn Chah again. He wouldn't use the cup. He'd use his hand. And as I was waiting to come in here, just after breakfast, I was looking through the window of my room in the house over there, and there was a nice tree in front. Because it was very windy and a bit stormy, the tree was blowing all over the place. And I recalled Ajahn Chah's simile of, why does a leaf or a branch move? It's not because it's part of the nature of a tree or a leaf to move. In fact, the default nature of a leaf is to be still. If you leave it alone, it's still by itself. It only moves because something outside of it is making it move. The wind. And Ajahn Chah continued with that simile by saying, your mind is essentially still. That's its nature, to be still. It only moves because you want something. You make it move. So if you stop making it move, no wanting, no aspirations, no goals, not trying to attain something, put all that aside, and then the leaf still moves, but less and less and less, until it becomes perfectly still, which is its default state. So that's how this mind works. We sit down, relax our body, and relax our mind. We don't want anything. We don't want anything in the whole world, just sitting here, just watching our peaceometer. Then your breath starts to emerge. I always wondered why the breath was the most common meditation object used. And it became quite clear that when everything else settles down, there's actually two things which have to keep moving. One of them is the breath, the other one is obviously your heartbeat. But people aren't so aware of their heartbeat, but certainly you are aware of your breathing. When everything else is not moving, you you can feel the rhythm of your breath. And the rhythm of your breath is very comforting. As long as you don't force it, if it's a natural breath, and I often wondered why that was the case, why it's a pleasant object to watch in its own right. And I remember just when I was in my mother's womb, that was the rhythm which you could feel, the rise and fall of her breathing in her stomach. In the first few days of your life, outside the womb, breastfeeding on your mother's chest, there too you could feel the rise and fall of your mother's breathing. It's a rhythm which has been embedded into us from the earliest times, which gives us a sense of warmth and safety and comfort. So the natural rhythm of the breath can be very reassuring and comfortable and easy to watch. So that's why when it does start to happen, you get very peaceful and your mind just starts to go onto your breath, breathing in, breathing out, in, out. It is naturally delightful as long as you don't interfere with it. And just like the body becomes very delighted and very relaxed just sitting here, so does your breath become delightful. When the breath becomes delightful, don't just think, oh, this shouldn't be happening, I should be doing something, I should be doing some insight or something. If you're enjoying this, well done. You're supposed to enjoy meditation. I've been a monk for 45 years now. I don't do this because I'm a masochist, because I'm afraid of relationships, or because I've got nothing else to do in my life, so I might as well become a monk. The reason you become a monk is you enjoy it. It's incredible fun. So much joy and happiness in deep meditation. So, when the mind becomes delighted, let it be. Enjoy the delight of the mind. And when it says really delightful, then it says so delightful, the breath just disappears. And the delight is all that remains. And beautiful lights and images in the mind. If you want these things, the wanting disturbs everything. If you just let it be, it happens by itself. This is a natural progression. And you get into some incredibly deep, powerful states of mind. That's how the meditation works. Yeah, so you get into these deep meditations, you bliss out, get into ecstasy states. So what? That empowers your mind. You get really alert. Your mindfulness gets extremely sensitive. It's one of the things still in mindfulness training people still miss. It's not just being mindful. How powerful is that mindfulness? It's not like just turning on the lights. How intense are those lights? Until the mindfulness becomes superpower. Mindfulness. Really strong. So you can really see deeply into anything. That's where the meditation really starts to take off. And that's not just for monks and nuns. That's for you too. As long as you follow the instructions. What happens to many people is they only read the instructions when something goes wrong. But as a meditator, we read the instructions first, before it goes wrong. And then we don't break so many apparatus. So that's the basic meditation. Any questions, comments, or complaints? No? Okay, if that's the case, then we can just have a stretch, and then we'll do a guided meditation for half an hour. So you want to have a stretch first of all. It's not toilet break, because it's amazing how much time people spend in the toilet. And we have to wait for everybody. So just have a good stretch. once you've had a stretch and got yourselves comfortable, then we can do our first meditation. Maybe for, we can do 40 minutes maybe. Yeah, good. So don't go around talking to everybody, because that means that it disturbs the mind. So try and keep silence. I know there are people you haven't seen for a while, and say hello to people. Yes, okay, very good. Very good. Okay, so now please, if you can find your seat again and sit down comfortably. I believe there are still some seats upstairs, is that correct?
Yes, there's a lot of there's cushions and chairs upstairs, so you'd like to be a little more comfortable and a little more space, there's a live screen up there, so you'll be able to see just as well as down here.
And you still get the energy which goes up through the roof.
Well, you get it higher, don't you?
You get it higher realms, the higher realms. Those are for the more advanced meditators allowed up in the higher realms.
And I just forgot to mention before, I'm sorry about toilets. There's also a toilet upstairs. There's a toilet when you go out these doors here round to the left. There's gentlemen and women's toilets. And also there are two toilets in the car park, so please make use of those toilets as well. Thank you.
Very good.
And just be careful that we keep this exit door clear, please. Excellent. Thank you.
So we'll do, it works out well, 40-minute meditation. And I will guide the first 15 or 20 minutes, and then afterwards I'll be quiet. The reason I do this is just so to get you going. And then if I kept on talking all the time, it would take away your ability to explore the meditation and to find your own wisdom of how to go deeper. But the first 10 or 15 minutes is where I can make sure you get on the right track to begin with, and then leave it up to you. Okay. So we close our eyes. The purpose of closing your eyes in this form of meditation is because it gives you more space inside of your brain to be able to feel the body and to listen to the sounds. It's one sense, one of the major senses which you don't have to waste time on, or visual data, or just stop for a while. And we begin by feeling our body, not with our hands, but with our mind. What do I mean by that? When you see a doctor, the doctor says, "How do you feel?" It may be you've had an operation on your hand. So how does your hand feel now? And that question means the patient puts their awareness on their hand and can report to the doctor the symptoms. In the same way, when you ask your own legs, how do you feel? It sends your mindfulness to that area of your body. You become aware of the feelings in your legs, and you get to know whether they're in the best position for this meditation. And you don't just endure, if your legs, you realize that they're not in the best position, then experiment. Change the position of your legs. But change them mindfully, awareness. So you feel them before and after the change. To see whether it's a change for the good. Or whether it's just making things worse. This way the mindfulness and the wisdom begin to grow. You're aware of the best position for your legs this morning, which may not be the same position as yesterday. And then you're aware of the feelings in your buttocks. Because I always see people fidgeting during meditation, if I keep my eyes open. The reason is because we just take that part of our body for granted. We just plonk our butt down on a chair or cushion. But paying some attention to it, adjusting it, making sure the cushion's just on the right place, really helps later on. And then you become, ask your back, how's your back right now? Physiotherapists have told me the most comfortable position, according to what they know, for your back is to be leaning backwards from the vertical about 15 degrees, which is exactly the inclination of the backrest of most chairs. So if you wish to lean back, fine. If you want to lean forward and keep a straight back, fine. If you want to slump, fine. You find the best position for your body now. Because people usually have tension in their shoulders, I pay special attention to my shoulders and relax. How do I relax the tightness in my shoulder blades? Those muscles, I imagine that those muscles are like a bunch of strings being pulled apart. And I let go of both ends. And in that little mental exercise, that imagination, I find my own muscles, the real ones, they also relax. And I can feel relaxation happening. I'm aware, and the awareness gives me feedback of how to relax my own shoulder muscles. As for my hands, I was just taught when I was young to put my right hand over my left hand, thumb slightly touching. We don't need to do that. Become aware of how my hands are right now. And I relax them. And I go back up to my shoulders and my neck, making sure my head is well balanced on top of the neck. Because I have a little irritation in my throat, don't try to get rid of that irritation. Just aware of it. Just what the body does. It's a croaky voice. That's okay. I make my peace with it. When I make peace with it, it gets a little bit better. I try to heal it, if I have negativity towards it, it gets worse. It's interesting to see, to experiment. You know how to make peace with your own body. Or what? makes symptoms worse. Then I go to my face. The muscles around my eyes and my mouth, maybe my forehead. That tells me any emotional stress in my mind being played out in my facial muscles. When I relax the muscles around my eyes, relax the muscles around my mouth, it's like I'm also relaxing my emotional world. And no fear, no aspirations, just peace, just being here, just taking a break, just from the striving of life. I've worked so hard, come so far, now I'm just going to sit down and enjoy this moment. Once my body starts to relax, I feel the whole body is relaxed to the max. And it actually feels delightful. I feel my body. It's like it says, thank you for paying attention to me. Thank you for caring for me. And I get this delight, my whole body like it's been to a Californian spa, feels so at ease and relaxed, and I indulge in that, and my body gets more relaxed. When it's the right time, I turn to my emotional world, my peaceometer. From 1 to 10, how peaceful am I? I look at that needle which gives me the feedback. And I experiment, if you don't know already, what makes your mind more peaceful? What makes it agitated? What turns the needle up towards 10? What lowers the needle closer towards 1? What's the cause of peace, stillness? You'll notice thinking. Thinking is the inner speech. It talks back to the world. And when you're talking, you're not listening. In silence, you listen. You're aware, receiving information. You get peaceful. And any future thoughts? Your future is being made right now. this is the only time you have. If you make this a moment peaceful and kind, you're doing the very, very best for your future by being still now. So don't get deceived into planning. And in this moment, sometimes you can hear the sound of the cars or the birds. Sometimes you can feel your breathing. As the breath comes in naturally, as the breath goes out according to its nature. Just being with your breath, not controlling it, but treating it like a friend. Focusing on the breath, the delightful breath. You have nothing in the whole world you have to achieve. No tests, no exams, nothing to prove. Just being with the breathing. Kind, peaceful. And try to listen to this world. Don't get caught up into thinking and commentating. Space between the thoughts. I'm going to be silent now. The next time I start talking, in about 15-20 minutes, we'll be close to the end of the meditation. getting close to the end of the meditation. How do you feel? How peaceful is the body? How relaxed is the mind? And how much delight, delight in silence and peace. Three times to end this meditation. Hope you got some nice peace and enjoyment out of that 40-minute meditation. So, are there any questions anybody would like to ask? Oh, go on straight away. Yes.
I wonder when I sometimes sit to meditate as to, is it better to use a particular technique sometimes, whether it be focusing on breath or doing body scan, or sometimes just simply sit and be. Sometimes I feel like just sitting and being, but I feel like, if I want to work towards, you know, my spiritual progress, is it better to use a technique or just be?
Sometimes techniques are just natural. You don't have to use a technique. But nevertheless, that if you have a technique which you've trained in before, then fine. But use that at the beginning of a meditation. As you get deeper and deeper and deeper, you'll find that all these techniques of body scan or just messing around with your breathing, they're all unnecessary. Because the stillness comes when you're not doing anything. You're just being peaceful. It is true that sometimes that when you are still, many people, they don't know what to do, so they tend to fall asleep. Now that's a common problem, but just hang in there, because soon the sleepiness vanishes. It's as if that we have a more subtle object, stillness, peace, silence, nothing really to excite us. And so it takes a much more subtle attention to be able to stay with a peaceful mind. But after a while, you get used to this beautiful stillness, and it gets more and more delightful. In this last meditation, I was really focusing and emphasizing the delight in meditation, to appreciate it. And one of the reasons, as I mentioned in a talk yesterday, that when I first became a monk, used to stay up one night a week meditating. It got to about 11 o'clock, I got very, very sleepy. And I wondered why. Because about a year before, I was still a layperson, I used to go to these all-night parties or rock concerts. And 11 o'clock, I wasn't tired or sleepy. And it wasn't the noise of like a rock concert. It was the fact that I was just enjoying what I was doing at 11 p.m. Therefore, I wasn't tired. And the fact that what was missing in meditation, which was making me sleepy, which stopped me engaging, was a the delight, the interest, the happiness. And sometimes I appreciate just, isn't it wonderful when I was meditating just then, my body could vanish and I didn't need to cough. Now I'm back into my body, got to cough again. Just my body doing this, whatever it's supposed to do. So sometimes it's wonderful being free, just in meditation. And I really appreciate that. And I delight in it. That's my delight, my happiness as a monk. And what happiness does a monk have? You know, we can't watch movies. Harry Potter, I don't know what that means. Even recently, Game of Thrones. Oh, no, what's the recent one? Someone was telling me about Endgame. Avengers, Endgame. They asked me a question in Indonesia about Thanos. And what the heck are you talking about? See, everyone else in the world knew about that, but not me. But anyway, that they had to explain it to me exactly, just, you know, how Endgame, like super men and women and stuff, and about Thanos apparently had six stones or three stones or something, and he brought them all together, and then you could have a wish, whatever you wish. And they said, Ajahn Brahm, if you were Thanos and got the six stones all together, what would you wish? What would be your wish? To destroy half of humanity? Said no. To destroy greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what I would destroy. Oh, that's an interesting answer, they said. Well, I'm a Buddhist. What do you expect? I'm not into world conquering or domination. Anyway, just sometimes just enjoying being still and being peaceful. Just happiness. Yes.
I kind of surprised myself because I had an imiter, and then of course because I surprised myself I lost it straight away.
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, after a few minutes, I mean, I tried to hold it, but then it went. So can you talk a little bit about, well, I mean, I know what I did.
And what happens,
it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, but thank you for bringing it up, because it happens to many people, because we have all sorts of expectations. And just even like to expect something to happen. Now, expect is looking outside of this moment, looking somewhere else. So we don't expect. The opposite of expect is inspect. The opposite of excite is is insight. In other words, going inside. And that's the idea of many times these deep meditations happening when you least expect them. And of course, the obvious example of that was Ananda. And Ananda's enlightenment, who was, you know, the attendant of the Buddha, sitting next to the Buddha for 25 years, listening to all the greatest of teachings, and seeing monk, nun, person after person coming up to the Buddha, and we said, yes, well done, enlightenment, full enlightenment, another arahat in this world. And getting so impressed, except for Ananda just was getting nowhere. And even when the Buddha passed away, Ananda still wasn't an arahat. I thought, what hope is there for me? Sitting with the greatest teacher, I couldn't make it. Now he's gone, what shall I do? But they had this big meeting together, the first council. And they decided to have 500 members in this first convention. And obviously to get all the arahats, the enlightened ones. But what about Ananda? He wasn't enlightened, but you know, he was so knowledgeable about what the Buddha taught. So because of that, he got an invite. And he thought, how embarrassing Tomorrow I'll face all my friends, 499 of them fully enlightened, and I'm the only one who isn't. That's pretty embarrassing. So he decided to meditate all night. Give it everything he got. Use every skillful means and every technique. And when the dawn came, he was still getting nowhere. Still not enlightened. So he decided to take a nap before the meeting. He let go. He gave up. He stopped trying. And before his head hit the pillow, he became another enlightened being, an arahant. He wasn't expecting it to happen that way, but that's how it happened. Mm. And so, sometimes we don't know what we're doing, we're just relaxing, letting go, and things start to happen. The water becomes still. And once the water is still, we look, hey, it's still. Hey, look at this. It's still. Oh. And we mess it up. So if it's still, just leave it.
So this morning then I had the problem, don't want that, put it down. So I just went into, I did the peace omita thing, yeah. And then I actually just became peaceful.
Exactly.
And that was really lovely. And yeah. Then I found, like, a lot of joy.
Exactly, because peace gives rise to joy.
Mm.
The reason why it's joyful is that, again, it's again a natural state, the energy of our mind. We waste our energy. I waste our energy in thinking and doing stuff. And just imagine all that energy has got nowhere else to go except into your mind, not thinking, not changing, not doing anything. And the energy of the mind builds. And it becomes delightful. And I said that story yesterday, the gross story, about going to the toilet and seeing the most beautiful piece of shit I've ever seen in my life. And, it's gross. This is actually true. I've written about this in, I think, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book. And why? Is a piece of feces inherently beautiful? Of course not. It's just what the mind puts into it. The mindfulness was so strong, so much joy. Everything was happy and beautiful. And this is actually why the breath becomes delightful. It's beautiful. Why? Because the mind is powerful and strong. So you're having lots of joy because the mind was getting some power, some joy coming up. And that's the wonderful thing about the Dhamma. It doesn't matter what you're experiencing. Everything becomes so much fun and so much joy, so much bliss. It's coming from the mind. For those of you who know the Anapanasati Sutta, 5th, 6th, 7th stage of Anapanasati, you're breathing in, experiencing piti, breathing in and out, experiencing joy, breathing in and out, calming that citta sankhara. It's created by the mind, the piti, the sukha. It's not inherent in the breath, it's how the mind adds on to things. It's energized. It becomes how the mind enjoys the breathing. The most beautiful piece of shit, that was actually a citta sankhara. It wasn't a body sankhara. It was a citta. The mind was so powerful. It could look at anything. It's just so gorgeous. And of course, you're watching the breath. You're watching whatever. Because it's so beautiful, you can't take your eyes away. You get effortless focus. Just like I was so easy to stay awake listening to, what was it, the Doors and Jefferson Airplane play all night. And no tiredness at all, I'm enjoying it. So this is actually why when you have that joy, that's what overcomes the tiredness. You really get into it, this is great. I don't want to fall asleep. It engages us and it gives you energy and joy. A natural form of joy coming from stillness.
Until in these states of peace and joy when we are in non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Does that help us to develop our wisdom?
Absolutely. It's develop wisdom. What wisdom? We may have wisdom to be able to understand how the stock market works. We may have to have the wisdom of how to get elected in the next government. But that sort of wisdom is not so important. It's the wisdom about the nature of the mind and the body and how this all works. That sort of spiritual wisdom, now that is really important. And of course, you know, the nature of the body. The body vanishes in meditation. Good riddance. My old body, it's getting old now. Really old, like yours as well, Liv. Yeah, it is old. So, you're welcome at old age. I think it's really cool being old. And you get many privileges being old. Can I retire, please? Can I? No. No, no. Okay. No, but what it means is that, you know, that your wisdom is the nature of the body. So you work with your body, you don't work against it. You work with your mind, you don't work against your mind. And then you just realize, all these things are not yours anyway. Nothing to do with me. And you allow everything to vanish. A sign of being detached is you can put things down when you need to.
So what I'm hearing, Bhante, is even the short, brief periods of meditation, we should then contemplate on what you're saying, the body and everything else. Is that right?
Yes, it's just contemplation just happens naturally. You don't actually stop to contemplate. Just, this is, even the word contemplate sounds to me like too much thinking. I almost like prefer the word explore. So this was a little simile which I used, of all places, in South Korea, Daejeon, in the 2015 World Computer Congress, where I gave the keynote address, which was really weird. What is Ajahn Brahm doing? So he needs help to actually, to, you know, sometimes when emails don't work, and needs help, you know, in the community. And I was giving the keynote address at a World Computer Conference, and I held up, it's actually one of the plastic bottles of water. What's this? I asked the audience. And they were actually very compliant. They sort of said, oh, you know, it's a cup. It's got blue markings on it. It's got water in it. What is it? Let me hear some more. And all that was just thinking. But after a while, they ran out of words. I said, no, that's contemplating. You're allowing the mind to be still and just to observe this. And instead of giving it names, let it teach you what its meaning is, and hold it for a long period of time, and really interesting insights come up. So you explore, you allow the mind to stay with something and explore it in ways you've never seen before. Innovation. And that's actually what contemplation, you make the mind to be still, they can hold an object and stay there for long enough. And especially the nature of your body. People think they understand their body. Remember just years ago when we used to go and see autopsies, just asking the coroner, or not the coroner, the guy, the chief pathologist or whatever, the guy who did the cutting up of the bodies. He said, oh, this is what you do all day. Now, how do you feel? Now, we're pretty sort of direct. Now, you're a guy, how do you feel going and, you know, having relations with your wife? It's an interesting question. He said, well, no, I compartmentalize. I just, you know, my body is one thing, but the corpses which I cut up on the table is something completely different. And there's a separation there. But then, so, you know, even like a pathologist, do they really understand sort of the body? Even if you work with them all day. But as a monk, you only understand the body when it vanishes. It disappears. And that's that simile which I developed. And it's the only simile which I have. But I had to actually to change it when I was in Indonesia because the election results weren't out yet, and apparently the nickname for Jokowi was Tadpole. And this is the story of the tadpole and the frog. And so when I started mentioning tadpole, they said, quiet, quiet, use something else. But anyway, any Indonesians here today? Did you know that sort of, that's right, what was Jokowi's, it was a bad nickname. He said he was just somebody who raised tadpoles or something. Yeah, something like that, yeah. But anyway, so a tadpole born in the lake, how can a tadpole ever know what water is? No more than a fish can know what water is. Even though it lives in water, swims in water, spends all its days in water, can never know the nature of water. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is one day the tadpole grows into a frog and doesn't really know what it's doing. It just jumps outside of the frog, like you experience some peace. Where did that come from? It just grows and jumps out. Now that frog, outside of the water, something which has always been there is now missing. Some which is always taken for granted is now gone. Water. And that's the only time a tadpole or a frog can realize the wetness of water. Same when a person leaves their body in deep meditation. Don't mean not floating through the air, but just the body vanishes, you go into the nature of the mind. You realize this body is suffering. It's a pain. Not even if it's old, but even if it's young. Being free from your body. The Buddha always would keep on saying those things, you know, the body is a prison because it's made up of cells. You know, it's a pain. But now you're experiencing it. Freedom from your body. This is so peaceful, so wonderful, so joyful. And you understand, if you make the connections there, why would you ever be afraid of death? Death is a release from so much bodily suffering. Why should ever people always be crying when somebody's died? You should be celebrating. Yay! My auntie is free of suffering. Whee! You know, that was actually, to be quite honest with you, when my mother passed away, she had Alzheimer's for many years. When my brother called and said she passed away, she died, I thought, great, well done, Mum. You're free of prison. The prison of having this terrible, you know, she was well looked after, but being the prisoner of Alzheimer's, it was a liberation. So I was actually quite, not because I don't love my mum, but because I was pleased for her. She was out of that pain of her body.
So Bhante, the word exploring that you use, that comes naturally. I'm hearing that, is that right?
Yeah, it comes naturally, exploring, yeah.
So we don't have to contemplate then.
You don't have to, no. If you have a look at that, that's in one of the sutras there by the Buddha. These are a natural path. One who has especially deep meditation from samadhi, from stillness, they don't have to do any contemplation. It happens naturally. Tamata.
Is there any question or four?
Oh, yes, quite a few couple over here.
Sorry to go again, but had one follow-up question. So are we saying that if our mind just simply becomes quiet and peaceful and still, then that's where potentially insights would come from, rather than worrying about a technique of vipassana that's meant to bring you insight?
Correct. So it happens quite naturally. In fact, that if you start contemplating when you haven't gone deep enough, you'll find you just, it's old stuff, what you've heard before. It's nothing which is penetrating and which is really overcomes some very deep misunderstandings of the Dhamma. So you go so still. So you go to the jhanas, because it's in the jhanas where when you come out afterwards, the five hindrances, I mean, those are things which stop wisdom happening. So you don't see what you want to see, what you expect. You're not in any denial. You see what's really there. And of course, there's so many great psychology experiments about people not being able to see what they feel is impossible. And of course, the major one there was that little experiment done in Imperial College in London. You know, my friend Bernard, Professor Bernard Carr, told me this one, that so one of his colleagues decided to demonstrate levitation of a flower pot. And he got all of his colleagues, these were really top professors in London, experimental scientists, to come and see a demonstration of levitation. And he came in with the flower pot, carried it in, it's possible to see it's just a flower pot, you know, no tricks, no wires, put it on the laboratory table, got all the cameras, infrared cameras, ultraviolet cameras, you know, just everything, so to take a really good recording of this if it happened. And then he asked all of the people in the audience, all his professors, can you please help by chanting Om? And all his professors, because they were friends of his, started chanting Om, Om, Om. And because of that holy chant, or at least when they started doing that chant, the flower pot lifted up off the table. It worked. He levitated the flower pot. Had cameras there. And they recorded everything. And even when some of those professors, they were there, they saw it. He said they were supposed to have seen it, but they said, no, it never happened. It was on the table all the time. It never rose up in the air. It said, well, here's the photographs, photoshopped, doctored, fake. It had risen above the air, but the whole purpose of that experiment was not to demonstrate levitation, because what had actually happened, they'd installed a huge electromagnet under the bench. And that's what actually levitated the flower pot. But they had to, you know, whenever you turn on a very strong current, powerful current, it always makes a humming noise. So in order to make sure that the trick was not exposed, they had to get everybody to chant Om, 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 just to disguise the current. But that was not the purpose of the experiment. They even trained scientists, when they saw something, it never actually came to their conscious awareness. It was denied access to awareness, simply because it was just too impossible. So the idea of bare awareness, by the time it comes to your conscious awareness, it's already been filtered and bent. Except when the mind has been cleared of those hindrances which bend the truth to fit what you want to hear, what you want to see, what you want to feel. That's the purpose of deep meditation, to take away that distortion of our perceptual framework. And we see what's impossible. I know that people love psychic stuff. But you know, my life as a monk, you've seen some really weird stuff. And people love weird stuff. There's this monk, do you remember the monk Sudama in Indonesia? Very powerful monk. He would teach meditation in Bangkok. One of the people I knew very well, she freaked out one day. She was in the meditation class. She realized something was going on. And this monk was looking at one of the meditators, and laser lights were coming out of his eyes into this meditator. A really juicy psychic power, not reading minds, because anyone could actually cheat on that one, but real laser lights coming into the mind. Do you believe that? If you saw that, maybe you would even see it. Because you've been denied, such a thing can't exist. This is one of the reasons why reality can be weird. We can deny it. We're not even aware that it's happening. We just can't see it. That's the nature of perception. The nature of knowing. so much of it is suppressed because it's just too challenging. Go on.
Hasan, we have a few online questions. Do we have time still?
Yeah, sure, I'm happy.
Okay, so one, maybe a quick one. If one meditates with eyes open, facing a blank wall, is it possible to enter nimitta or jhana with open eyes?
Yeah. No, it's not really. You have to close your eyes sooner or later. But that time when I was very light to explore different techniques, different ways of meditating. And I remember going to that Zen monastery in North England years ago. And that's how we had to meditate. Open eyes facing a whitewashed wall. Because I'd meditated before, I knew how to be silent and peaceful and just not expect anything in the moment, not thinking. And then that blooming wall vanished. It disappeared. It just wasn't there anymore. That was freaky. Walls aren't supposed to vanish out of existence, but it did. And I thought, wow, this is amazing, this is great. I wasn't scared, I was like intrigued. And of course, it's just a natural phenomena. If you watch a wall and really put your attention on that wall and nothing moves or changes, the brain turns off the sense of sight. Because the brain will only be able to notice things which change. If it's always there, you don't notice it. Just like a computer, if you don't tap the keyboard or move the mouse, the screen goes blank. Sound. If the background sound doesn't change, then of course the sound turns off, doesn't hear it anymore. So this is actually where you get a lot of wisdom about the nature of the mind. It only notices things which change. Things which are always there, you can't see them. You can't perceive them. That's why the taupo can never know water. Except when water stops. When it anichas. That's what anicca means. Something always there has gone. Impermanence.
Thank you, Ajahn. And there are two questions that are related. They're about suffering that comes up or aggravation or pain that comes up during meditation and what to do about that.
Yeah, we'll just move. Just change the posture.
I think it's less physical suffering than mental suffering. Once I seem to suffer and get meditation wrinkles on my temple.
Meditation wrinkles on your temple? My goodness, try Botox. No, it's nice actually to let go of your body as soon as possible. So in other words, follow the instructions, you get nice and comfortable in your meditation, as best you possibly can. Relax the body. And then when you go into your mind, relax your mind, at that time, you know, you're part of the car, you're not sitting in the car anymore, you're sitting in this hall over here. Just leave the car outside, it's well protected. And then you can just enjoy the peacefulness of not having a body for a little while. And then you can enjoy the breath or the mind, whatever you're watching. And then the body just relaxes by itself when you're not watching it. When I was meditating, I wasn't coughing. I don't think I was, anyway. But, you know, now I'm sort of back into my body, you know, just the irritation, you cough every now and again. So just the wrinkles all go when you meditate.
I can't see their answer, but I'm sure they're happy with that.
Okay. Very good. Excellent. Okay, so now it's a bit early for that. Yeah, excellent. So do you want another... Okay, excellent, great.
I think there are more questions.
Yeah, okay, yes, we can do that. And of course, you know, once we have our lunch, and you can actually tidy up if you can, please have your lunch as mindfully as possible, so don't use it as an opportunity to go and chat to one another. Try and keep a bit of silence in the place. And you know, when we finish this afternoon, then you can do all your chatting if you want to. But right now, you know, keep a nice, contemplative, peaceful, still atmosphere. And then it means that it enhances the meditation. And it's, you know, if you feel a bit tired, you can have some tea or coffee or something if you need to. Find a nice quiet place you can meditate. And then I'll be back here at about 1 to actually do some more meditation and some more instructions.
Could you explain what enlightened like? And is it something that comes and goes, or is it something that stays with you?
Yeah, what enlightenment is an easy question. At least it should be easy to answer. Because it's one of the reasons why, you know, being born in a Christian world, going to a school which has an Anglican chaplain, you know, I was really interested in spirituality. So I remember going up to the chaplain and asking, look, now I don't want to criticize anything, but what is this God we're supposed to worship? Now, describe it to me. I just can't get my head around what is God. And they said, well, God is the ineffable, it's beyond words, the ground of all being, the Alpha and Omega, that's, you know, the A to Z. It's the ineffable, you know, beyond words. Yeah, but actually, what is it? That doesn't mean anything to me. The ground of all being, I know what the ground is, and get some idea what being is, but ground of being, it was just like gobbledygook words. And so then later on, when I became a Buddhist, I remember going to ask, you know, one of the top Sri Lankan monks in London, what is enlightenment? It's beyond words. It's ineffable. The ground of all being. I think I've heard that somewhere before. But then later on, you know, you go to some you get to somebody who actually really meditates and just goes very deep in meditation, and they get some wonderful innovative answers. And of course the best answer, what is enlightenment, is that story of the 5 children with a wishing game. And not only does it show what enlightenment is, but it also makes it easy to understand where people go for other forms of happiness and meaning in their life instead of enlightenment. And even though the story is easy to understand, please never think it's not profound. People sometimes make a mistake. They think if they can understand it, it's not deep. In other words, the more that I can confuse you, oh, that's really deep teachings. But people would understand when the Buddha taught, even people with very little education. So did the Buddha not give deep teachings? Of course he did. So this is the 5 children playing wishing game. The game has these rules. You have a wish. Whoever gets the best wish can win the wishing game. First kid said, I wish for a new Nintendo, a new computer game. I don't know anything about computer games, but anyway, you get some idea. Okay, very good. Second kid said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game shop. Because with my own shop, my own store, I can get a new computer game when the next one comes out. It's obviously superior than just having one computer game. Third kid, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $100 billion US. And with such a large amount of money, I'd buy my own computer game store. But the trouble is, my parents never let me play computer games. They say I should do my homework first. So then I'll buy my own private school. And because I pay the teachers, including the principal, I'll make sure they always give me top marks. So I can spend no homework needed, and I can always spend all my time playing computer games. When I graduate from my own school, I can buy my own university like Mr. Trump did, and I can give myself honorary degrees. And that means I can get all these qualifications and certificates and spend all my days doing computer games. And whenever there's something else which I need with $100 billion US, I know I could spend that amount of money. It won't, no human being anyway in that one life. So I'd always have something, some money to get whatever I want, whenever I want it. It's obviously superior. There's two more children left in the computer game. In the wishing game contest. The next girl, really wise, she said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. And for my first wish, I'd have the computer game shop. My second wish, I'd have $100 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. That's a pretty smart girl. And the next person said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That's enlightenment. Not an infinity of wishes, which is power. Not just an infinity of wealth, which is, you know what, I'd never understood why it is millionaires, billionaires, Mr. Trump's, even Mr. Turnbull's, why they want to join politics. And why they want to get into that for? They've got enough money, they can retire. Why do they want to do that for? It's like power. You have the ability to have wealth, get whatever you want, but that's not enough. Then you want all your wishes sort of fulfilled. But beyond that is being so content you never needed any wishes ever again. The end of craving, end of wanting, enlightenment. That's why in meditation, if you can let go of wanting just for a little bit, and just to see how the mind becomes so still and contented and so joyful. Why did I ever want anything before? And when I let go of wanting, my mind becomes so joyful and so peaceful. A taste of enlightenment. A taste of freedom. So this is actually what enlightenment is. We taste it when we get into deep meditation. I ask you now, just usually we're not supposed to think too much of the past, but in your life so far, what's been your happiest moment? The moment which stands out, where you felt so content, so happy, so joyful. The sort of moment when you remember it and you think, could I change anything to make it better? I know you were with the person, the people which you know you want to be with. A time when everything seemed to be just so perfect, you didn't need to change anything. You were so content. There's the times when you didn't want anything. You didn't want to change anything. That moment was just satisfying as it was. It's a moment where all wanting, all desires, all negativity, for some reason, had subsided. You had a glimpse, a taste of freedom. So happy, so content, not wanting anything in the whole world. Shame it didn't last. If it lasts, it's enlightenment. Freedom. Okay, next question.
I'm not sure how best to word this question. For meditation, what's the ultimate goal of meditation based on the Buddha path versus meditations with yoga center and all the lifestyle meditation courses out there?
Okay. To put it bluntly, the main goal of Buddhist meditation is abandoning all goals. Abandoning all goals. all destinations, all places you want to be in the future. Not self-improvement, but number one, just realizing you're good enough as you are. You just go according to nature. It's not your fault if you have a cough or if you fail. It's not a great, wonderful thing that you're healthy. It's just nature, that's all, nothing to do with me. None of my business. So no goals. Just being here. Having a goal, an aspiration, takes you away from being here. I don't know why that, when I was young, people never had any of these bucket lists. Things they had to do before they died. And it's crazy, it just gives you more business, more work, more travel, more stuff to worry about. So wonderful, if your bucket list, what do you want to, where do you want to go, what do you want to do, what do you want to achieve before you pass away? Nothing. Nothing. I do have friends from other religions. If they're cheeky, I'm very respectful of other religions and people of different faiths. I've got an amazing time over in Indonesia. Just even one of the organizers of, I think, my retreat in Bandung, she was a Muslim. She was the head of the committee organizing my retreat. Well, that was really cool. But, and there's many Christians there as well. But anyway, that... But if any person of a different religion gets cheeky with me, I give as good as I can. So anyway, this Christian friend said, I was going overseas and had a conversation. He said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to admit, come on, you know, I've known you for a long time, you're a truthful, honest person, that nothing is higher than God. I looked at him and said, yeah, you know, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And he looked at me surprised that I gave in so easily. You mean you sort of believe in God? And I said, nothing is higher than God. Nothing. Emptiness. That's much higher than your God. And he said, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. I was just having fun, and he knows that. I was just having fun with him. So we just enjoyed a good laugh together. Or just like the old Benedictine abbot, which I really sort of had good friends with. Abbot Placid, his name was. We had a Benedictine monastery up in the north of West Australia. And I remember we had great fun together. We were just walking through this monastery once, and I said, this is a very old monastery. It's one of the oldest buildings in West Australia. And he said, are there any ghosts in this monastery? And he said, oh, in the Catholic Church, we don't believe in ghosts. What about the Holy Ghost? Got you, caught you. I don't know. So we had great fun together. So humour is a wonderful part of our spiritual life. So never abandon your sense of humour, lightheartedness. That's it, is it? No, I can't. Yeah,
there's one.
Yes, one over there, yeah.
Hello, John Brown.
Hi.
So every time I face a stressful situation, at the end of this, like after facing the situation, I get peaceful. So how do you keep your mind so you get peaceful in the stressful situation?
In a stressful situation, you just don't have any goals of what you want to achieve in a stressful situation. It's the outcome is not important, it's the process is important. So, you know, to try and sort of get to some goal, this is what I want to achieve, it means that just the end will start to justify all sorts of terrible means. It's okay to tell a white lie because it's really, really, really important. No, it's not. So it means the stress of the moment. You can only do one thing at a time. So you be in this moment. Be kind. The person in front of you is the most important person in the whole world. And if you make this moment
as beautiful, as kind and caring and as aware as you possibly can. And the stress disappears. Stress is just like the guitar string. You stretch it. There's pressure on it. Something pulling you one way, something pulling you the other way. If you can lessen the tension, so the future is not pulling you to some sort of goal or some sort of outcome. And the past, you know, I really failed last time. I don't want this to happen again. You're not being stretched by the past or the future. You let those past and future go. You're in this moment. There's no stress. When you don't want anything, you're just being kind, being caring, being alert in this moment. All the stress vanishes. We're not dragged down by the past, by the trauma, the failures, what perceived failures of the past. Then when you let go of the past and future, there's no stress. There's nothing pulling you one way or pushing you the other way. There's no, don't worry what other people think of you. Because that also causes you stress. Trying to live up to other people's expectations. Your mother's expectations, your partner's expectations. Oh, there's so many expectations. And it just drives you crazy sometimes. Other people's expectations of me, that's not my business at all. So, leave that alone. That's your problem. So
when you face that problem, what you mean is just be there?
Just be there. Yeah, be there and just expect the unexpected. Because sometimes you think it's a problem, it turns out it's not a problem at all. You actually made up the problem. You looked at something and you're the one who added problem to whatever was happening. Being sick is not a problem. Dying is not a problem. For those of you who want to see, there was a story from experience. It's in, I think, the first book, Open the Door of Your Heart, of pushing the wheelbarrows for 9 days. I remember just, Ajahn Chah said we had to move all this earth, pushing the wheelbarrows for 3 days, which was really hard work, really dirty and stinky. But of course, after 3 days, I could take a rest, meditate, wash my robes. But then he left the monastery to visit somewhere else. And the second monk said, no, we put it in the wrong place, we've got to move it. Another 3 days I had to work. He had a good point, I can understand the logic of his reasoning. 3 other days we had to move that earth. And after 6 days of work from 9 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock in the evening, he couldn't really see very much anymore. And really dirty, tired. I never became a monk to become a labourer. I was being exploited. But at least after 6 days, I had faith and my teachers knew what they were doing. And then after 6 days, I thought, now can I take a good rest and really wash myself? And then Ajahn Chah came back and he said, I thought I told you to put the earth over here. Now it's over there. Move it back again. That's why I totally lost my faith. And then the wisdom of these teachers, I started swearing. And one of the monks saw that I was not happy. And they came up to me and they gave me this beautiful wisdom, which I will never, ever forget. They said, thinking about it is the hard part. Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Oh, wow. That was worth 6 years of pushing wheelbarrows. So, whatever you have to face, problem in life, difficulty, having a biopsy, having a mastectomy, just, you know, having a death or whatever, thinking about it is the hard part. That's what causes the problem and suffering. So learn just how to just do it, see what happens. You know what's going to happen, just good, bad, who knows? You've got to shrug your shoulders when you say good, bad, who knows?
Thank you, Mata Jan, for doing this retreat. So if somebody is, we talked about stressful situations. If somebody is sort of sitting face to face, like the boss from hell, and actually berating you, how do you actually deal with the situation, like, face to face? How do you cope with that?
Easy.
Shrug my shoulder?
Yeah, just listen.
Right. Okay.
And he said, very good.
Okay.
You don't believe a word of it. And then as soon as you go, there's some reason for that. Sometimes it's the boss is in a bad mood that day. Well, you know that story. It was the girl who was over in Sydney who went she was called over to London, all the way from Sydney, to actually sign this contract, take her business up to the next level, fashion business. And they said, we're ready to sign the contract. So she had this little girl, Holly, very beautiful little 3 or 4 year old, and said, well, I have to go over to London to sign this contract. So her husband looked after the kid, and she flew over there, moment's notice, just had time to check into the hotel, have a shower, go to the boardroom. All the directors were there, but not the boss yet. And they said, who are you? I said, I just came over from Sydney, flew all this way, hadn't any rest yet, because I was called, oh, you, yeah. You might as well fly back to Sydney now. The boss is in a filthy mood. Boss, in no way is he going to sign your contract, or any contract today. It's best to get out of here. No, I've come all this way, at least I'm going to see him. Suit yourself. So what she did, she went into a corner of the boardroom, sat on the floor, crossed her legs, and did some meditation. The loving kindness meditation. May all beings be happy and well. May all bosses be free of suffering. And she was good at it. So when the boss eventually came into his boardroom, and you notice how control freaks such bosses are, saw this woman he's never seen in his life before. Who's that? What is she doing in my boardroom? Was that effective, by the way? Does that sound angry? Because I often say I never get a chance to get angry as a monk. So sometimes when I say stories like this, I really get into it. And so, you know, and he was glaring at her like some monster. And so because she'd just been meditating, she just stood up. Walk right, it's not scared, because you don't get scared when you've been meditating. Went right up to the boss, and she said these words just tumbled out of her mouth, just not intentional, just preformed. She looked into his eyes and said, "You have such beautiful blue eyes, like my daughter Holly back in Sydney." That's not what a boss from hell expected. He was trying to intimidate her, and instead he got this sincere praise. And he didn't know how to cope with that. And she said his face was just total confusion until it softened. And he smiled after about 1 or 2 minutes, said, "Really? I've got beautiful blue eyes." And they signed the contract within the next minute. And she was so happy. But she wanted to go home to the hotel to take a rest. She was jet lagged and tired. But the directors would not let her go. They said they formed a circle around her. Said, "We are not letting you out of this boardroom until you teach us how the heck you did that." That is how to treat a boss from hell. But you cannot plan it. It has to really come from the heart. And, you know, you can just totally, if you're a meditator, just like the Buddha, face down Nalagiri, the mad, crazy elephant. And the crazy elephant was subdued with loving kindness. Okay. So I think it's probably time for lunch now.
I think so. Just make a quick announcement regarding traffic. There's one car, Mazda RCG256, which is parked across the road. Can your owner please repark your car because its apparently it's blocking the driveway? It's just a little bit, but the house owner is not happy with it. Anyone's parking along Fisher's Lane, one side of the road is 1 hour parking. So if any of you is parking on that side of Fisher Lane, please, it's time for you to move your car before you get any bills from the council. Thank you.